When Singapore's founding father Lee Kuan Yew was asked about the secret to East Asia's extraordinary economic rise, he replied, "It's really quite simple. You must have land reform, export-oriented industrialization, and financial discipline." This deceptively straightforward formula, implemented with ruthless precision, transformed impoverished agricultural societies into industrial powerhouses within a single generation. Yet despite its proven success, this development model remains surprisingly controversial and widely misunderstood. Joe Studwell's How Asia Works has become required reading in boardrooms from Tokyo to Silicon Valley, with Bill Gates calling it the best book on economic development I've ever read. The book's core insight, that successful development follows a clear three-part formula, while failures deviate from it, challenges conventional wisdom about free markets and reveals why some Asian nations prospered while others stagnated. The economic divergence between Northeast and Southeast Asia represents one of history's most remarkable natural experiments in development economics. In the 1950s, South Korea, Taiwan, Malaysia, Indonesia, Thailand, and the Philippines all had similar GDP per capita levels around $800 to $1,000 in today's dollars. All were predominantly agricultural societies recovering from colonialism or war with comparable literacy rates, infrastructure development, and natural resources. South Korea had been devastated by the Korean War, while Taiwan was rebuilding after Japanese occupation. Southeast Asian nations were emerging from colonial rule under various European powers. What explains this dramatic difference? The successful states implemented three critical interventions that transformed their economies. First, they radically restructured agriculture through household farming, implementing comprehensive land reforms that broke up large estates and distributed land to small farmers. South Korea's land reform of 1950 limited holdings to 3 hectares per family, while Taiwan's land-to-the-tiller program created a broad class of independent farmers. Second, they directed manufacturing development with strict export discipline, requiring companies to meet international competitiveness benchmarks to receive state support. For instance, Korean firms had to achieve specific export targets to maintain their licenses and access to credit. Third, they subordinated their financial systems to these developmental objectives, directing credit to strategic industries while maintaining strict oversight of capital flows. The unsuccessful states failed on all three counts. In the Philippines, land reform was repeatedly blocked by powerful landowners. Indonesia and Thailand maintained their traditional agricultural structures while allowing speculative investment in real estate and finance. Their industrial policies lacked the strict performance requirements that characterize Northeast Asian development. This divergence became starkly apparent during the 1997 Asian financial crisis. Japan, Korea, Taiwan, and China either avoided the crisis entirely or recovered quickly due to their strong industrial foundations and controlled financial systems. Korea, despite initial difficulties, reformed its corporate sector and emerged stronger. Meanwhile, Malaysia, Indonesia, and Thailand suffered currency collapse, inflation, and permanently reduced growth trajectories. Thailand's baht devaluation triggered a regional crisis that revealed Southeast Asia's dependence on short-term foreign capital and speculative investment, rather than genuine productive capacity, much like Brazil's miracle growth in the 1970s that collapsed during the Latin American debt crisis. The successful Northeast Asian model wasn't new. It followed patterns established by earlier developers like Germany's industrial policy under Bismarck, America's 19th century manufacturing development, and Britain's earlier agricultural transformation. But its implementation in post-war Asia achieved unprecedented speed and scale, transforming poor agricultural societies into industrial powerhouses within a single generation. Japan pioneered this approach in the 1950s and 60s, followed by South Korea and Taiwan in the 1960s and 70s, with China later adopting many of the same policies after 1978. Their success demonstrates that development isn't about geography, culture, or luck, it's about specific policy choices and their rigorous implementation. By 2020, South Korea's per capita income exceeded $30,000, while Indonesia remained below $4,000, highlighting the enduring consequences of these divergent paths. Imagine trying to feed your family from a backyard garden. You'd use every square inch efficiently, starting seedlings indoors, regulating soil temperature, applying targeted fertilizer, planting crops closely together, using vertical trellises, and intercropping plants with different maturation times. This gardening approach is precisely what made Northeast Asian agriculture so productive. Farmers utilize sophisticated techniques like terracing hillsides, building elaborate irrigation systems, and practicing careful crop rotation to maximize yields from limited land. When market forces operate without intervention, agricultural development typically stagnates. Landlords extract higher rents as demand for land increases, while tenants lack security and capital to improve productivity. This creates a vicious cycle where farmers cannot invest in land improvements or new technologies, leading to decreased yields and deeper poverty. After World War II, Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, and later China broke this cycle through radical land reform that divided agricultural land equally among farming families and provided government support for credit, marketing, and training. These reforms included fixed purchase prices for crops, subsidized fertilizers, and extensive agricultural extension services. The results were spectacular. Agricultural output increased by 50 to 75% in just 10-15 years. These small farms, typically 1 hectare or less, functioned as highly productive gardens, achieving yields far higher than large-scale operations. In Taiwan, smallholders consistently outperformed large estates in plantation crops like sugar and bananas by 40 to 50%. Even today, Chinese rice yields exceed American yields by over 50%, despite using much smaller plots. This efficiency came from intensive cultivation methods, including multiple cropping seasons, careful water management, and optimal fertilizer application. Family farms could provide this level of attention to detail that large operations found impossible to replicate. This agricultural abundance delivered multiple benefits beyond just food security. Rural consumption created demand for consumer goods, allowing companies like Toyota and Honda to develop products for cash-limited but extensive rural markets. Farmers became first-time consumers of motorcycles, small tractors, and household appliances. Agricultural self-sufficiency preserved precious foreign exchange that would otherwise be spent on food imports, enabling investment in industrial development. And household farms provided crucial social welfare during economic downturns, allowing laid-off factory workers to return temporarily to family farms rather than becoming indigent. This social safety net function proved especially valuable during the 1997 Asian financial crisis. Most importantly, land reform created unprecedented social mobility by distributing society's most fundamental asset equitably. South Korea's President Park Chung-hee, Hyundai founder Chung Ju-young, and Taiwan's pioneering industrialist Wang Yung-ching all came from farming backgrounds, a kind of mobility that remains almost non-existent in Southeast Asia. This new class of small landowners became the backbone of rural savings, entrepreneurship, and education investment. Their children, with secure food and income at home, could attend school longer and eventually move into industrial and professional careers, creating an educated workforce that powered the region's economic miracle. The Philippines stands as a stark example of how agricultural policy failure can fundamentally undermine national development. Despite implementing numerous land reform plans dating back to 1904, the Filipino elite has masterfully circumvented meaningful reform through a combination of legal maneuvering, political influence, and outright resistance. Ferdinand Marcos declared martial law in 1972, partly justifying it as necessary to implement comprehensive land reform, yet achieved less than 25% of his already limited targets. The pattern continued under Corazon Aquino's 1988 Comprehensive Agrarian Reform Law, which proved equally ineffective due to carefully crafted loopholes. Most notably, her own family's 6,400-hectare Hacienda Luisita exploited these loopholes through stock distribution options rather than actual land transfer, exemplifying how wealthy landowners maintained their control. A journey through Negros Occidental, known as the Philippines' Sugarlandia, reveals the stark contrast with Northeast Asian agricultural development. Vast sugar plantations dominate the landscape, where undernourished cane cutters earn a mere $2.60 for backbreaking daily labor, barely enough to sustain their families. While the government proudly claims to have reformed 6.8 million hectares, careful analysis reveals that only about 300,000 hectares, 2.5% of cultivable land, underwent genuine compulsory acquisition. The rest involved voluntary sales at inflated prices or public lands that were already occupied by farmers. Today, an astounding 8.5 million of 11.2 million rural workers remain landless, perpetuating a cycle of poverty and dependency. The economic consequences of this failed reform are evident in productivity metrics. Philippine sugar yields average just 56 tons per hectare, dramatically lower than the 85-90 tons achieved in family-farmed areas of Taiwan and China. The disparity becomes even more striking when examining agricultural value-added figures. The Philippines generates a mere $655 per hectare compared to $2,500 for China, $5,000 for Taiwan, $7,000 for Korea, and $10,000 for Japan. This productivity gap reflects not just technological differences, but fundamental structural problems. As noted agricultural economist Wolf Ladejinski observed, tenant farmers act rationally by not investing in land improvements when a lion's share would go to the landlord, moneylender, or merchant. This creates a self-reinforcing cycle where lack of ownership leads to underinvestment, resulting in lower productivity and persistent poverty. The failure of Philippine land reform also has broader societal implications, contributing to rural unemployment, urban migration, and social unrest. Unlike its East Asian neighbors who implemented genuine land reforms after World War II, the Philippines' agricultural sector remains trapped in a colonial-era structure that continues to impede both agricultural productivity and broader economic development. Agriculture alone can't sustain economic growth beyond a decade or so. Emerging economies must transition into manufacturing. This transition is particularly critical as agricultural productivity improvements eventually hit diminishing returns, while manufacturing offers virtually unlimited potential for technological advancement and productivity gains. Manufacturing is crucial for poor countries' development for two key reasons. First, it uses machines to mitigate the shortage of productive human skills, allowing rapid productivity gains through mechanization rather than pre-educating workers. This mechanization enables workers with limited formal education to become highly productive through on-the-job training and experience with industrial processes. Second, manufactured goods are freely traded globally, enabling poor countries to learn productive skills and acquire technologies from advanced economies through direct participation in global supply chains and industrial networks. The challenge for policymakers is steering entrepreneurial talent toward manufacturing, particularly large-scale operations that can compete globally. This requires state intervention through both protection and subsidy to create space for entrepreneurs to learn competitive manufacturing. Protection might include temporary import tariffs, while subsidies could encompass preferential lending rates, infrastructure support, and technical assistance programs. However, these interventions bring the risk of rent-seeking, where entrepreneurs focus on obtaining protection and subsidies without delivering technological progress. This phenomenon has plagued many developing economies, where protected industries remain perpetually infant, never achieving international competitiveness. The solution implemented by successful Northeast Asian economies was export discipline. A policy of testing and benchmarking protected domestic manufacturers by requiring them to export and face global competition. Countries like South Korea, Taiwan, and later China implemented sophisticated systems where continued access to domestic market protection and state support was contingent on meeting specific export targets. Export performance revealed whether firms deserved continued state support, as success in international markets provided concrete evidence of competitiveness. Without this discipline, development policy became a charade where local firms pretended to achieve world-class standards without proving it in global markets. This export discipline approach created a powerful feedback loop. Firms were forced to upgrade their technology and management practices to meet international standards, while policymakers received clear signals about which industries and companies were worthy of continued support. The system also encouraged healthy competition among domestic firms as they raced to meet export targets and prove their viability. Successful examples include South Korea's automotive industry, which evolved from basic assembly to world-class manufacturing, and Taiwan's electronics sector, which progressed from simple components to sophisticated semiconductor production. Korea and Malaysia offer a revealing comparison of industrial policy approaches. Under Park Chung-hee's 1961 coup, Korea implemented ruthless export discipline, transforming family-run businesses into manufacturing-based global conglomerates like Hyundai and Samsung. Park famously arrested scores of leading entrepreneurs under a special measure for the control of illicit profiteering, forcing them to sign agreements pledging their property to national construction and committing to government-directed manufacturing investments. Chung Ju-young quickly adapted to Park's manufacturing focus, building Hyundai's first cement plant in 1962 and exporting within a year. By 1967, Chung had entered automotive manufacturing with a Ford joint venture. When developing Hyundai's first independent car, the Pony, the Chungs insisted on receiving the same engine Mitsubishi used in its equivalent vehicle rather than an underpowered version. They hired Italian car designer Ital Design for an independent body style and gathered additional ideas from visits to GM, VW, and Alfa Romeo. Though early models suffered quality problems, crucial learning was happening. By 1981, Hyundai was preparing for significant exports, strategically attacking the U.S. market when Japanese imports faced voluntary restraint agreements. By 2010, Hyundai had become the world's fourth-largest auto group, selling 5.7 million vehicles globally. Malaysia, under Mahathir Mohamad, attempted to copy Korea's approach but failed dramatically. Mahathir's Look East policy, announced in 1981, aimed to emulate Northeast Asia, but he failed to implement the crucial elements, export discipline and sanctions for failure. His national car project, Proton, formed an equity joint venture with Mitsubishi rather than pursuing technological independence. Without domestic competition or export requirements, Proton remained globally uncompetitive despite modest success in the UK market. The results speak for themselves. When Mahathir became Malaysia's premier in 1981, Malaysia and Korea had identical per capita incomes of approximately $1,560. By 2008, Korea's had surged to $21,530, while Malaysia's reached only $7,250. Financial systems in developing economies must be kept on a short leash to serve developmental purposes rather than seeking immediately profitable investments. Successful Northeast Asian economies maintain tight control of their banking systems, limited international capital flows, and directed credit toward productive sectors. This approach, while unconventional by Western standards, proved crucial for sustained industrial development. Japan, Korea, and Taiwan each had experienced painful consequences from losing control of their financial systems. Japan had seen Zaibatsu business groups manipulate banks to squeeze profits from manufacturers, leading to economic instability in the early 20th century. Korea's privatized banks in the 1950s stymied manufacturing development by focusing on short-term commercial lending rather than long-term industrial investment. Taiwan's KMT had lost mainland China partly due to financial instability and hyperinflation, which taught them valuable lessons about monetary control. Each resolved that money would serve national development, implementing strict regulations on capital flows and maintaining close oversight of banking operations. Korea pursued a particularly aggressive approach under Park Chung-hee. After renationalizing banks in 1961, Park turned the Bank of Korea into an extension of the Ministry of Finance and implemented unlimited rediscounting of export loans. The cheapest loans went to exporters at real interest rates of -10 to -20%, effectively paying them to borrow. Meanwhile, depositors received minimal interest, creating a hidden taxation system that funded industrial development. This policy, while controversial, successfully channeled resources into strategic export industries like electronics, shipbuilding, and automobiles. Southeast Asian countries, by contrast, failed to maintain financial discipline. The Philippines' banking system became essentially a kleptocracy, with banks functioning as personal piggy banks for business families, particularly during the Marcos era. Crony capitalism flourished as bank loans were directed to politically connected businesses rather than productive investments. Malaysia and Thailand maintained more orthodox monetary policies but prematurely deregulated their financial systems in the late 1980s and early 1990s, triggering speculative booms in real estate and stock markets. The rapid liberalization of capital accounts allowed massive inflows of short-term foreign capital, creating asset bubbles and increasing economic vulnerability. The results became catastrophically apparent during the 1997 Asian financial crisis. Thailand, which had been the IMF and World Bank's star pupil in financial deregulation, suffered the worst initial contraction. After depleting foreign reserves defending the baht, the government let it float on July 2, 1997, marking the official start of the Asian crisis. The IMF's prescribed austerity measures sent Thailand's economy into a 14% contraction between 1996 to 1998. The crisis spread rapidly to other Southeast Asian nations, revealing the dangers of premature financial liberalization and the importance of maintaining strong controls over national financial systems during developmental phases. Korea, despite its stronger industrial base, also suffered, but recovered more quickly due to its more robust manufacturing sector and ability to generate export earnings. China's remarkable economic rise since 1978 has largely followed the Northeast Asian development playbook, though with distinctive characteristics reflecting its socialist history. Like its successful neighbors Japan and South Korea, China began with agricultural reform, abandoning collective farming in favor of household plots under the household responsibility system. This simple yet transformative shift increased agricultural output by more than one-third in the early 1980s, with grain production jumping from 305 million tons in 1978 to 407 million tons by 1984. The reform not only boosted food security, but also created a surplus rural workforce that would later fuel industrial growth. In manufacturing, China has evolved through several distinct phases. In the 1980s, rural industry flourished through township and village enterprises, TVEs, which absorbed surplus agricultural labor while operating alongside modest reforms to state enterprises. These TVEs, numbering over 1.5 million by 1990, produced everything from basic consumer goods to construction materials, contributing significantly to China's early industrial growth. From 1993, under the more assertive leadership of Zhu Rongji, the government pursued aggressive rationalization through the grasp the big, let go the small strategy. This resulted in approximately 40 million state worker layoffs between 1995-2004, a massive restructuring that, while socially painful, dramatically improved industrial efficiency. Simultaneously, Zhu increased competition among major state firms by breaking up monopolies and creating competitive oligopolies in strategic sectors like telecommunications, energy, and banking. China appears to be doing better with state-owned enterprises than other Asian nations did, developing a unique hybrid model. From its socialist planning history and Zhu Rongji's 1990s rationalization program has emerged a roster of increasingly globally competitive midstream businesses like State Grid, Sinopec, and China Mobile. Protected from market fragmentation by high capital barriers, yet numerous enough to ensure fierce competition, these firms demonstrate that export discipline and domestic competition, combined with systematic culling of underperforming entities, matter more than ownership structure. However, China's state manufacturing model faces several significant limitations. Success is largely confined to midstream, business-to-business activities, while state companies struggle with consumer markets, where innovation and rapid response to changing preferences are crucial. Much of what Chinese companies sell internationally is subject to government procurement or approval, creating obstacles in developed markets where national security concerns can block acquisitions. Recent examples include blocked attempts by Chinese firms to acquire technology companies in the U.S. and Europe. Additionally, China's private sector, despite generating over 60% of GDP and 80% of urban employment, receives relatively little policy support compared to state enterprises, potentially limiting its long-term competitiveness in global markets. This imbalance has become more pronounced in recent years under Xi Jinping's state advance, private sector retreat approach. The recipe for East Asian economic success has been remarkably consistent across multiple countries and decades: household farming, export-oriented manufacturing, and tightly controlled finance supporting these sectors. This formula works by enabling poor countries to extract more productive capacity from their economies than their population's initial skill levels would suggest possible. Japan demonstrated this first in the 1950s-60s, followed by South Korea and Taiwan in the 1970s-80s, and most recently China since the 1980s. Markets aren't inherently efficient, as neoclassical economists claim. They're created and shaped by political power and institutional frameworks. The historical evidence shows that successful development requires recognizing two distinct types of economics: developmental economics, requiring careful nurture, strategic protection, and managed competition, and efficiency economics, appropriate for later stages with freer markets and less intervention. Countries like South Korea initially protected infant industries while forcing them to compete in export markets, only liberalizing gradually as industries matured. Unfortunately, intellectual tyranny from wealthy nations and international institutions forces developing countries to publicly endorse free market principles while quietly implementing the interventionist policies actually needed for development. The World Bank and IMF have provided terrible developmental advice with no basis in historical fact, as no significant economy, including Britain, the United States, Germany, or Japan, has ever developed through free trade and deregulation from the beginning. Even today's advocates of free markets developed through extensive government support and protection. We may never see another economic transformation like Japan, Korea, Taiwan, or China's because effective land reform, essential for sustained 7-10% growth without debt crises, is politically off the agenda in most developing nations. These Asian success stories all began with radical land redistribution that created a broad base of small farmers and prevented the concentration of wealth. Instead, today we get microfinance and microplots as band-aid solutions that don't address fundamental asset inequality. Southeast Asian nations could potentially use ASEAN as a vehicle for effective industrial policy in their 500 million person market, but they're signing bilateral free trade agreements with more developed states instead, limiting their policy space. The greatest lesson is that economic development involves complex, dynamic stages requiring constant adjustment. There are no one-stop solutions or universal formulas. Countries must learn when to transition from developmental policies to more open systems, a challenge that even successful developers like Japan have struggled with, as seen in its lost decades. The key stages include initial land reform and agricultural development, labor-intensive manufacturing for export, upgrading to higher technology industries, and finally transitioning to innovation-driven growth. But for poor countries seeking to escape poverty, the historical evidence is clear. Development requires proactive state interventions in agriculture and manufacturing to foster capital accumulation and technological learning. This includes directed credit, export promotion, selective protection, and coordinated investment in infrastructure and human capital.